Hello, and welcome to the UC Press Podcast, the podcast from the University of California Press. I'm your host, Chris Gondek, and today I'll be speaking with W. Joseph Campbell, the author of Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. W. Joseph Campbell is professor in the School of Communication at American University. He's the author of four other books, including Yellow Journalism, Puncturing the Myths, Defining the Legacies, and The Year That Defined American Journalism, 1897 and the Clash of Paradigms. W. Joseph Campbell, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So what is a media-driven myth?
These are prominent, well-known, widely repeated stories about and or by the news media that are widely believed and often retold, but which on close inspection, under scrutiny, these stories dissolve as apocryphal or wildly exaggerated. And I think they can be thought of as the junk food of journalism, in a sense that they're alluring and tasty, perhaps, delicious stories, but on the whole, they're not terribly nutritious, not terribly healthy.
So should we just think of these myths as bad reporting?
You know, bad reporting does help account for the emergence and, to an extent, the solidification of media-driven myths. But media-driven myths are more than that. These are prominent stories, as I say, about and or by the news media. These are widely known, widely retold. In many respects, these are some of the most cherished stories in American journalism, stories that journalists believe and, to a certain extent, draw upon for sustenance, for examples as to how best to do and best to practice journalism. So, yeah, sloppy reporting is a part of it, but it more helps explain how they emerge and how they take hold rather than as being synonymous with a media-driven myth.
So I guess in a way we should be thinking about these media-driven myths as mythological in that they are telling true stories, but whereas you might say, one, the Greek myths were what the Greeks came up with, these media-driven myths are driven only by but essentially for the media themselves.
That's very well put. That's actually a very good summary. And they are, as I say, widely held and widely believed by journalists and others to be true. And the fact that they are apocryphal or wildly exaggerated does tend to undercut the notion that journalists and journalism as a profession is a truth-seeking endeavor. And so if we're wrong about these stories, these prominent stories about American journalism, then it does cast a shadow of sorts across the profession writ large.
Let's talk about one of American journalism's shining moments, which is one of the myths you look at, and that is the See It Now encounter between Edward R. Murrow and Senator Joseph McCarthy, which ended up becoming the center point of the 2005 film Good Night and Good Luck. Looking at it from a mythological point of view, I mean, it's always shown as Murrow confronting Senator McCarthy and using the medium of television to expose him for what he was. Is that accurate?
The movie, the 2005 movie that you mentioned, really helped to reinforce the media-driven myth about the Murrow-McCarthy encounter in March 1954. And the movie had the effect, it was a pretty good movie, it was very well done, it was very clever too, and it had the effect of introducing to a whole new generation the notion that Edward R. Murrow and his heroic staff were the ones who really confronted and took down and ended the communists in government witch hunt that had been conducted by Joseph R. McCarthy. And yeah, that interpretation is the only one that you can take away from that movie. Good Night and Good Luck, really, it doesn't directly say that, but that's the only interpretation that moviegoers can come away from it with. And so it's nicely done, but the confrontation between Murrow and McCarthy, that certainly happened. Murrow devoted the entire broadcast of his See It Now program on March 9th, 1954, to an expose about McCarthy and his tactics and his bullying ways. But Murrow, as he himself later acknowledged, was very late to confronting Joe McCarthy. There were many journalists, columnists, and others who had been critically reporting about McCarthy, searchingly reporting about his ways and his tactics long before Edward R. Murrow took to the air with his See It Now program. And one of those reporters was a guy by the name of Drew Pearson. And he began to question and criticize McCarthy and McCarthy's communist and government witch hunt years before Edward R. Murrow took to the air. So it's the myth there is that Murrow brought down Joe McCarthy. And it's a funny thing about many media-driven myths. The principals themselves sometimes dismiss the notion, scoff at the notion that they had such a powerful effect. And that's the case with Edward R. Murrow. He said, you know, I didn't do what others haven't been doing for months and years. And he was right in saying so. So he kind of disavowed the notion that his program, his show, had that powerful effect.
Well, that's Murrow disavowing the myth. But I got a sense from your chapter on Walter Cronkite that after a while, the myth that Walter Cronkite's special report in 1968 on the Vietnam War caused Johnson to realize the depths of what he had lost in American public sentiment was a myth that Cronkite eventually became to believe himself.
You're right. And for many years, Cronkite, in his memoirs, which came out in the mid-1990s, he kind of disavowed the notion that this had his program about Vietnam that aired at the end of February 1968, disavowed the notion that had much of an effect. But late in his life, he did come to embrace the notion that it did have a powerful effect, that supposedly Johnson watched the show and had this immediate and decisive effect, realizing, like an epiphany, that his policy in Vietnam was essentially bankrupt and that he'd had to shift gears and even decide not to run for re-election to the presidency, all of which is exaggerated, all of which is untrue. Johnson, as my book describes, wasn't in front of a television set the night that Cronkite's show aired. He was in Austin, Texas, at the 51st birthday party of one of his longtime political allies, then-Governor John Connally. So the power of that anecdote, the power of what is called the Cronkite moment, resides in the notion that this had a dramatic and immediate and decisive effect on Johnson and on American public opinion and American policy in Vietnam. But as I say, none of that is true. All of that is exaggerated. And the Cronkite moment is one of the more compelling and best known of the media-driven myths debunked in Getting It Wrong.
Your last chapter deals with Hurricane Katrina, and apart from the fact that it's an historical event which is pretty much still fresh in most people's memories, for me what was interesting about it was one of the stories that took place outside of what you could consider kind of a centralized media situation. For example, when Cronkite broadcasters reported in 1968, there were only three television networks. When Murrow did his, I think there were three. One of them was Dumont instead of ABC. Katrina had a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations covering it. And I never thought about a myth around Katrina until you brought it up. So what is the myth that journalists tell themselves about Hurricane Katrina?
The myth is the myth of superlative reporting is how I describe the Katrina-related myth. And this emerged fairly quickly after the hurricane swept through the Gulf Coast and battered New Orleans and other places along the coast a little more than 5 years ago now. And the notion that the news media stood up to power-wielding authorities, to state and local and federal government officials and called attention to their lapses and to the indifference in terms of bringing aid quickly to the victims, the storm victims, particularly in New Orleans, is at the heart of the myth of superlative reporting about Katrina. But it overlooks that it's not only self-congratulatory, but it seriously overlooks the dramatically flawed reporting that characterized coverage in Katrina's immediate aftermath. The immediate aftermath of Katrina was characterized by the news media. And this was print, broadcast, and online media, as New Orleans having descended into anarchy, mayhem, Mad Max-like violence. I mean, it was just supposedly a nightmarish scene in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, with child rape victims and deaths running into thousands or tens of thousands. There was supposedly in Katrina, just crime sprees everywhere, nightmarish scenes of violence, and very little of that was true. Most of it proved to be highly exaggerated, that the most alarming stories were either unfounded or really badly exaggerated. And so the myth of superlative reporting is that the news media got it right and told truth to power. But in reality, the news media got it badly wrong on Hurricane Katrina, as many of their own retrospective reports done a month or so after Katrina's landfall clearly showed. And a government report, a report by a bipartisan congressional panel that looked at Katrina from all different angles, touched on the media response too, and said if anyone rioted, it was the media. And that was a damning indictment about the news media coverage by a bipartisan congressional panel. And it's cited in my book, and it's one of many, as I say, retrospectives that examine the news media coverage and found it badly wanting. In fact, worse than that, found it to have been badly exaggerated.
So we're recording this on the 1st of September, 2010. Is there a current story in the American media that you think might be mythologized in the future?
That's a very good question. I think that the universe of media-driven myths is not confined to the 10 that are discussed in Getting It Wrong. And I think there are a number of potential candidates that might make for a sequel someday. There's the concluding chapter, or the conclusion of the book, discusses some research done by a Princeton economist on the roots of terrorism. It's widely assumed that poverty leads to or contributes significantly to international terrorism. Well, his research, the Princeton economist's research, suggests fairly clearly that it's that poverty is not a major contributor to terrorism. Another one is the notion of farm parties, and by that I mean PHARM parties. There's a media critic in Washington named Jack Schaefer who's done some very interesting work debunking the notion of farm parties, in which teenagers raid the medicine cabinets of their parents for whatever kind of pills and medications they can get a hold of, bring these purloined pills to a party where they dump them into a bowl and take turns sort of taking handfuls of these pills and taking them, consuming them, and seeing what kind of reaction it leads to. The notion of farm parties has been widely reported over the years, and apparently it's apocryphal. Apparently it's untrue that there ever has been such a case. There's been no independent journalists' reports on this matter. There's been no real police reports that I've identified this kind of conduct happening. Yet it pops up fairly often and fairly frequently.
W. Joseph Campbell, the author of Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. Thanks so much for being on the UC Press podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu. You can also become a fan of the UC Press on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the UC Press podcast. Copyright 2010, The University of California Press, all rights reserved.